Well, hello and welcome to episode 140 of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Scott Casson-Rennie, himself.
Al Coates.
Oh, bit of a delay. And our very special guest tonight.
Satwinder Sandhu from CAA.
Returning guest, friend of the show, etc. Yeah,
all of that kind of thing. Satwinder, how was your second career as an audio book reader going? Because you've got the silkiest tones in adoption.
Thank you. I'm open to offers. All the publishing houses are welcome to contact me directly through this podcast.
Yeah, because we're getting a cut, 10%.
Oh, Scott, that reminds me. I've got to tell you about our deal. Can I, before we get into the news, and sorry, yeah. Simon, if you could just, you sip your coffee and I'll tell you. Right, someone got in touch with me, totally out of the blue, and said, hello. Like, it was one of those emails. Hello, would you be interested in a sponsorship deal or you know, some sort of merchandise or influencing kind of opportunity? And I just went, all right then. And they got back to me and went, well, my client makes cakes. And I thought, cakes. I'd sell my soul for a cake. I'm a simple creature. And they said, well, actually, my client, they sell cakes in boxes and send them out to people. Would you mention it in one of your socials or a blog or something? And I thought, okay. I'm not going to do it a blog. So I sent them back and I said, no, but I'll do it in my podcast.
That's right.
They were going to send me cakes. They weren't going to pay me in money, but in cakes. And I'll take cakes at this point in my life. After this week, I'll take cakes.
You're so cheap, honestly, for cake. I mean, there was a time, don't get me wrong, thanks to Glitter Nails, aka Claire, I put it out that I really fancied cake when I was recovering. And she spent 3 days trying to find someone that delivered cake in Ireland. And I ended up with a box of brownies coming from this company in Ireland. But now it's ice cream. Sorry.
Yeah.
So unless there's an ice cream man who's willing to sit outside my house.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. Mr. Whippy.
Yeah. Mr. Whippy.
Yeah.
Scott Casson-Rennie sponsors Mr. Whippy. Right. One more thing, and then we're going to get to the crux of it with Satwinder, who's patiently sipping his tea.
I know. Bless him. He's regretting saying yes to this week. Yeah.
Satwinder, could you say for me, Satwinder? Now, children, it's time to go to sleep. Say that for me.
Now, children, it's time to go to sleep.
That's great. I'm going to bottle that.
You'll be on CBeebies next, honestly. Oh, yeah.
Boom. If Cracking. This whole social work adoption thing falls through, you're in.
Which is highly likely at the moment. So.
Yeah, ooh. We'll
I'll save that one.
Mm-hmm. The next thing on my agenda is, I would really love anyone who's listening to stop what they're doing right now and to go off and put a rating on iTunes or Podbean or Libsyn or wherever they are. And we really appreciate it if you would do a review for us. Do it. Obviously, don't all go and put ones on. People going, yeah, I'm going to put a blooming review on. If you want to do a verbal review, you can do that. But even just putting stars on it, we would really appreciate that because it means that we get bumped up the algorithm and it means that people will listen to us more. Not that we're shamelessly plugging ourselves, but we're shamelessly plugging ourselves. So you're looking confused.
Wow, okay. Is this a new thing that you're going to do every podcast? Beg for people to review our podcast?
It doesn't matter. I'll take
care. Or is it jealousy that I was on another podcast this week? Sorry.
Shut your mouth. What podcast was that?
I can't remember. Oh, yes, I do remember.
You can't remember.
I do. That sounded very bad, didn't it? After that left my mouth, I thought, no, I shouldn't have said that. No, I was, myself and Tris were on Jeff Noble's FASD Success podcast, which I think is coming out this week or next.
Oh,
I'm talking about FASD Ireland. And it was really good, actually. You need to listen to it because you might get some tips.
Oh, well, I'm glad we've sort of had that conversation where you've put me in my place, well and truly. I will listen to it and I might even I'll maybe rate the episode or something.
Yeah, one star, yeah.
So hopefully everyone who's gone off and done that on their phones will have come back by now. So, right, anyway, shall we crack on? We've got a couple of couple of news items to do. Well, a couple of items, and we asked if anyone knew about it. And so that's why we've got Statwinder on, because we want to talk about the VAA, the Voluntary Adoption Agencies. But before we get to that, Statwinder, we've had a massive week in politics. Massive. So come on, what's your take on the news? Because it's 22, it's 8:45 on a Thursday night, and we've just had some news. So tell me, come on, week in summary, go for it, Sat.
Well, I mean, it's been a whirlwind in politics this week, and as we speak right now, there's still a lack of clarity about whether our Prime Minister has actually formally resigned or whether he's sticking around for a few months, and we have no idea really who's in charge of the Department for Education. There's been a few names. Somebody resigned within 24 hours. Our children's minister came and went and possibly is back again, which is good news, we think. So, I mean, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? I can't actually believe that this is all happening this week. But the reality
is, I've just had a text. All right, this is breaking news.
Is Will texture?
Right. So he was a junior minister. Will Quince was a junior minister, and now he's been bumped up to Minister of State for children.
Okay.
That's so a pay rise, isn't it?
So does that mean the role has changed? If he's
not back, I think that when Edward Timpson was the Minister for State for Children, and I think it got downgraded.
It got downgraded, didn't it? Yeah.
So, hot off the press, reaction, Satwinder.
Well, I mean, with a pending implementation of the Children's Social Care Review, I mean, I think that's probably the best news the sector could have heard, to be honest. I mean, when I listened to the minister on your podcast a couple of weeks ago,
well done.
He was consistent in his approach to his job and with conviction conveyed his passion for the vulnerable children that we're all, you know, responsible for and talking about. So politics aside, and I think he answered that question very eloquently too, politics aside, what we need in that role is somebody who believes in children and believes in a better future for children and is able to deliver what the care review is aspiring to do. So I think the worst possible news this week really was that he had gone, because it, of course, lives up to all of those poor expectations that we've often seen across the sector. So actually, we need somebody with conviction and some passion and able to deliver. And if he's the guy to do it, then let's get behind him.
I mean, I was gutted. I mean, I don't know about you, Scott. I mean, we talked to him for an hour, but I don't know about you, Scott, but I was like, oh man, that feels like a kick in the guts.
I was, and I don't know, because you actually asked him in the interview how long he was going to be around for, more or less. And to be fair, I think when he answered it, I just knew in my heart of hearts that the way things were going at that point in time, because what was that, 3 weeks ago we interviewed him? Two? I can't remember specifically.
22nd of June, wasn't it, or something like that?
Yeah. So they'd had the confidence vote, hadn't they? And there was lots of things being said and done. And then obviously on Monday, he put himself out there on the national media and kind of got behind all the furore that happened last week, the end of last week and over the weekend. And to be fair, I think from my own personal perspective, I think he did the right thing, because he was made a fool of in essence. But I can't say I was surprised given everything that's gone on in politics over the last, since Partygate, let's face it, it's like every day is just, you know, an eye opener, isn't it? Let's face it. So I can't say I was surprised, but the reasons that he resigned were quite different to the ones that I thought he would resign for.
Yeah.
So if he is back, obviously we'll see over the next day or so, I guess. If he's definitely back in that role, then fabulous. Because I, like that, I took to him. I thought that he was interested, and, you know, I think having spoken to some previous ministers, they don't sit there and take notes or acknowledge you or whatever. He did. So I think for me, yes, like you, Al, I was a little bit gutted, but not, it wasn't unexpected, if that makes sense. I think what I was surprised about was Nadeem Zahawi kind of not jumping ship, because if you're going to get the opportunity to be a chancellor and you've got that experience or whatever, I don't know, because I don't know him as an individual, but I guess that you're going to go for that kind of role. But, you know, he's not been what was his title?
Secretary of State.
Yeah, for whatever it was.
Education.
Yeah, that's right. he hadn't been that for too long, had he? And he's bounced back and forward between the kind of the departments. So, and then, of course, he got made chancellor. And then today he was rather honest in an open letter that he posted online about the state of affairs in number 10.
But it just, I don't know, it sort of felt like it came back to this feeling of, you know, we really felt like, put politics aside, different colours of the, you know, all of that. You think, so we were having a really interesting conversation about the care of you and thinking that actually that had the potential to be scuppered epically. Someone who has oversight over it, who has an informed decision, you know, talking to people at the DfE, you know, they've taken a year to train him up. That sounds a bit flippant. But he spent a year, coming up a year in post, where he's invested himself in meeting people, so he's got an informed decision. And then for some wannabe minister to then get dropped into it, but it didn't happen. So hopefully the ship is back on track.
Hopefully.
Or is it? Who knows?
Well, who knows? We'll find.
Yeah, this season has been used as being a cracker. Yeah.
By the time this goes out on Saturday, it could all have changed again.
Yeah, you could be in charge. There's three of us. Chancellor, Prime Minister.
Do you know what? I can't even manage my own wallet, never mind country's wallet.
I nearly said and Queen, but that was going to be really too far.
Well, who would you choose, Al?
Me, of course. get myself out of a sticky wicket. And the reason we asked Satwinder on was to talk about VAAs, voluntary adoption agencies, because there was a news recently in relation to Families for Children, and they shut down, or they announced they were shutting down. So, right, let's have a proper interview with Satwinder, because you've kindly come on. You're very, very long day, and you've given up your time for us. So,
and you got permission.
Tell us, did you go and ask permission to speak on behalf of?
Oh, I mean, I'm vice chair of the CVA board. And I've been in that position for just over a year. So obviously I have some oversight across the sector, and I felt that, but despite having that seat, I did want to speak to Maggie Jones, who is the CEO of CVA, just to run it by her and say, well, are you happy for me to publicly speak on behalf of the organisation and our members? And then, of course, I know Ruth
Marriott.
Can I
just ask you, sorry, I don't want to cut across you, but could you just explain for people who maybe don't know who the CVAA are? Because it's not a prominent organisation, is it?
No. So CVAA is the Consortium of Voluntary Adoption Agencies. So we are a collective of not-for-profit and charities across the whole of the UK in our membership. So many of the members have been around for a long time. Some of them were linked to religious institutions historically, but basically we are a quarter of the adoption sector, particularly in England. So
as much as a quarter?
Yeah. So the last kind of data we had was that a voluntary adoption agency was still placing one in four of every children that's being placed for adoption in England. So historically, of course, we've been involved in placing children, in birth records counselling and supporting adopted adults, working with birth families, but primarily in the preparation of families that we recruit for adoption and placing children with them through our local authority and now RAA partners. And again, historically, RAAs, sort of VAAs, voluntary adoption agencies, have had a reputation for working with families who are offering more than the standard. So when we talk about the priority children or the hardest to place children, it's families for those kids that we tend to focus on, not exclusively, of course, but certainly in the voluntaries I've worked for, we've often had a policy where if somebody wants to adopt a newborn, straightforward, healthy baby, if a thing, such a thing exists.
I was going to say, I could see people having funny feelings about that phrase.
Yeah, exactly. So we often would have said, no, we can't work with you because we are only looking for families for children over the age of three, or for children with, who are being placed with brothers and sisters, or with disabilities and additional needs. So that still stands. And that's partly why the data is still showing that we account for nearly a quarter of all children being placed, because I think there's still an ethos around trying to meet that need for children.
Do you, I mean, can you explain what the landscape looks like in a, structurally? Because that obviously we went from 152 local authorities and 20 some.
Yeah,
we're so down to about, is it 32 RAs?
Yeah, so I was with Sarah Jo Hull on Monday. We were both presenting at a conference together. So she confirmed that there are now 32 RAAs, regional adoption agencies, across England.
Right.
And so they're obviously made up of different types of local authorities, different size and scope. They all, not all, but they have many different formats in terms of their structure and their link back into their local authorities. Some of them have become VAAs in their own right. And there's only one local authority, as I understand it, that at the moment still isn't part of an RAA, and that's Cornwall. But as I understand it, they are joining one of the Southwest RAAs soon.
I hate the analogy, but it's like the wheezy kid being picked for football, isn't it? It's like, I'm probably losing my registration over the phrase wheezy kid. There's probably some sort of...
colleagues in Cornwall would see themselves as, you know, the kid that actually is the leader of the pack. So they've remained independent and we're doing this ourselves, thanks very much. But there is now a requirement from the DfE that they join an RAA. So they are joining a team as such.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the landscape for RAAs. And obviously with VAAs, we're all over the country, so there is coverage right across from the northeast and northwest through to the Midlands, the southeast, southwest, and London. And of course, there are other VAs in the other nations across the UK. Yeah. But so, in theory, we do have good geographical cover with regional arrangements for local authorities and the traditional setup for voluntaries. But even in the time that I've been with CVAA, the numbers of voluntary adoption agencies have dwindled because some have combined forces and merged. I was part of a merger of two voluntaries that I worked for in 2010. So when I was director of adoption and fostering at PACT, we acquired Childlink, which was another smaller voluntary in London, but very successful. And that allowed PACT to expand across right across the southeast. But like Families for Children, who've sadly announced that they are closing their doors at the end of August, there have been other voluntaries that have not been able to succeed in finding an alliance or a partnership, have been losing staff and then income because there's fewer and fewer children being placed with the voluntary agencies. And therefore, it's as simple as there's no income. And whilst we are charities or not-for-profit organisations, unless we think and act like a business, with the pounds and pence coming in, and if we can't afford to run, then we can't afford to exist like any organisation. So, sadly, that's what's happened. Families and children.
Probably one of the biggest ones. There was two, wasn't it? I mean, the British Association of Adoption and Fostering, which wasn't really a voluntary agency, but that was kind of that went. But then after adoption, that was probably the biggest one. Because they had a massive coverage, and for an organisation so big, and you know, we now know the reasons behind it because of lack of placements. Do you think regionalisation has? Well, I know the answer to this, but I'm asking you anyway. Regionalisation has it had a slightly negative impact on the number of children being placed with voluntary agencies as a result of regionalisation?
I think it's one of the factors. So obviously the ambition for the government was to rationalise the resource in local authorities and bring these regions together, which of course makes sense. The setup of 150-odd adoption services across the country was always a nonsense. But as we know, in adoption services, we, and I say we as a collective social workforce, get very precious and territorial about our little patch of the world. So whether it's an LA, an RAA, or a VAA, you know, we have that sort of mindset often. And I think it's partly down to skill set, the experience and quality of work that we want to deliver. But the impact of the evolution of RAA is coming on the back of all of the legal judgments that resulted in numbers of children coming through on adoption plans dropping anyway. I guess there's a double whammy right across the sector. So the numbers of children being placed now, we know from the ASGLB data, regardless of who's placing them with families, the numbers of children being placed across the board have dropped to, you know, some of the lowest levels ever. And as a social worker, of course, I'm absolutely behind the principle which has been enshrined in what we've seen in the Children's Social Care Review, which is when a child needs to be removed from their family and isn't able to stay with their birth parents or whoever's been caring for them, the options around permanence should A, be looked at equally, but should include the full range of right from adoption through to being placed on some kind of order, usually special guardianship with a family member who can safely care for them. Now, we know that that's not happening consistently, certainly not across the country. RAAs are only responsible for adoption in the most part, so they're not permanent organisations. So there are still some gaps there, but I think what's happened is the investment in RAAs, of course, has resulted in them being able to develop, innovate services. We now, of course, have a national leader in Sarah Johal, who's fantastic. And, you know, the leadership she's giving to the heads of RAAs across the country is inspirational, and there's lots of great stuff happening. And I've had the pleasure of being able to work alongside her in lots of different capacities, because there is also collaboration happening with voluntary. So we are part of that decision-making and delivery forum, but we don't have legal responsibility for the children. So the decision-making around where they go isn't happening in VAAs. And so I think there is some fallout as RAAs seek to become more sustainable in their own right.
I mean, that's fair. That was sort of leads into my thoughts around it. So what does the future look like? Because we've seen a steady stream. I mean, firstly, thinking about the impact of the people and the adoptive parents and the children who are with families for children. Do we know what is the impact on them? Because, you know, I'm presuming that, I don't know how, they're 20, 30 years old, are they?
Going to be turning 30 this year. So I have had the opportunity to speak to Ruth Marriott, their CEO, who I know really well as a fellow CVA board member and trusted colleague and friend. So Ruth has been working really hard with her team to make sure that the families, obviously once they have been notified formally that this is happening, they are working to ensure that their families can be passed on to other organisations, primarily RAAs. So I imagine that where there are children with families already and not yet legally adopted, the RAA that placed them may be able to take on legal responsibility for that family. And obviously there are large RAAs in the Southwest already. We've got Aspire, Adoption West and Adoption Southwest. So I know they're also looking at what they can do to support the families that remain at different points of the process, because of course there'll be families in the very early stages who will have only recently applied or maybe be in stage one or two of the process. So it is complicated, but I guess from a personal perspective for families, I know when I've spoken to adopters in the past, one of the reasons they choose to come to voluntary adoption agencies is because they're independent. We have a smaller kind of setup usually, so there's a more intimate and personalised aspect to the service. Not always. And I know certainly, again, one of the developments in the RAAs has been to kind of replicate some of that. But the reality is voluntary adoption agencies are independent. We have our own governance structure, whether it's with trustees or a governing board. We're not part of a big corporate local authority type machine, which RAAs still are. So the bureaucracy and the time it can take to get things done doesn't exist. So I've worked in voluntaries where families have rung up in the morning needing adoption support. a therapeutic service has been mobilized. And this is a real example. By the evening of the same day, a clinical psychologist was in the family's home with them and the child. That just doesn't happen in an RAA
the cogs turn slower. I was thinking about this and seeing some of the noise, and there's not been an awful lot of news of stuff around this, but I'm also conscious that, I don't know about you, Scott, but often people, it's a question you get asked is, you know, RAA or VAA, what is the, when people are at that very sort of fork in the road at the very beginning, what are the benefits of the RAA versus the VAA? Do you think that the balance is, the news like this is kind of itself perpetuating, that it's going to be, is there nervousness within the CVAA and the sector?
And there's nervousness in the sense that this has been happening and coming for a long time.
Right.
So, you know, when organizations like After Adoption folded, and we've had other organizations, as I said, that have become part of larger VAAs and setups because it's more sustainable and economies of scale exist. I think the nervousness, therefore, has been really around, well, having had a long history, and in the case of organizations like PACT and Corum, for example, they've been going for over 100 years, hundreds of years in Corum's case. We've been kind of thinking, well, we need to, as organizations, stay ahead of the curve. We need to keep innovating. And I know we use the word innovate a lot in social work and doesn't often mean much, but in the context of voluntary adoption agencies, it really is about, well, what is it that families are telling us that they need? What is it that adopted adults are telling us they need? And what can we be delivering on behalf of the sector? So I think in some cases, there is lots of additional service delivery happening. But like a lot of these things, as charities relying on either donations or income to run services, if they're not being commissioned, then they can't be run or sustained. So RAAs or local authorities are often still the commissioner. And quite frankly, I mean, I know there's lots of reasons why, but the commissioning arrangements in local authorities have just become beyond manageable. So unless you have a dedicated team or expertise within your organization to be navigating these hundreds of pages of documents sometimes, you know, it's a really big ask. And
is part of that then some of the financial arrangements? Because I know that if you, obviously that we've got issues, and I think people often in the UK sort of see that, oh, well, adoption's free, but it's not free.
It's not,
you know, someone's paying someone somewhere. It's free at point, it's like the NHS, it's free at source.
Yeah, well, the DfB roll out the money, don't they, to the, well, it comes through the DfB and the Treasury, primarily to local authorities who then set up these budgets. Now, we know already, not just from anecdotal evidence, but from what we've been told by colleagues, that the budgets that have been devolved down to RAAs vary enormously. And in some cases, they're simply not fit for purpose. So the RAAs are struggling to deliver high quality services across the board because they've not been properly budgeted for. So on a personal example, I run the Intercountry Adoption Centre. I know categorically that Intercountry Adoption, which usually is commissioned out, wasn't even on the radar when it came to adoption and the creation of RAAs. And we now have learned that adoption support was also given very little thought in terms of budget. So when there's challenges around budgets and choices that heads of RAAs are having to make already, inevitably the impact is going to be felt by the voluntary sector, because actually we rely on the interagency fee. And for those people that don't understand the interagency fee mechanism, the reason adoption is perceived to be free is because there is direct funding from local government into RAAs to cover their costs. And to cover the costs of VAAs providing families, the fee is exchanged at the point of placement.
And so that it's worth noting that when we get into the nuts and bolts of that, is that like as a VAA, you are paying for your building, you're paying for your admin staff, but you're to get someone approved, someone has to pay the social worker who comes out and approves you. Someone has to pay the social worker and the panel members, all the admin stuff. So it's a big layout of money, isn't it?
And that's why this whole concept of the economy of scale of your back office functions and VAAs has become such a big consideration, because in principle, we're all doing the same thing. We all need to offer HR support. We all need to have panel administrators. We need to have people doing certain functions in order to deliver the legal requirements of what it takes to approve somebody who's suitable to adopt. And that's before you even get into all of the policies and the safeguarding stuff around assessments. I was looking at the costs.
Sorry, I was going to cut across because I've got the figures. So for one child to be, if you as a VAA, you, whatever, after, not after adoption, adoption matters, just hypothetically, they spend all that time, they approve a family, they, you know, that they, a great family, perfect match for a child. They want to take, they got quite a broad scope, and then they sit on the shelf for 6 months, not unreasonable amount of time, maybe a year. And eventually a child's identified from an RAA, the local authority then would pay the VAA £33,871 for one child to be matched into that family.
Yeah. And that, in theory, then covers some of the cost right back to the point of the VAA taking out a recruitment campaign to attract adopters to their door in the first place. Then all the social work function that's then delivered. So, and there's research happening at the moment. So CVA are involved in an update of the cost of the interagency fee and its value and the impact it has. So obviously when, what we hope for is that when a child is adopted, that this is a lifelong arrangement. And despite the highs and lows that come with the needs of adopted children, we want families to be supported and sustained so that they can raise that child into adulthood and hopefully have the level of independence that's, you know, within their grasp. So this is a kind of, as you know, it's a social investment on that level. I know that's an awful phrase to use when we talk about children, but we're investing in these children's future. So whilst it can seem like a lot of money to some people, one, it's covering true costs, but secondly, it is then also, an element of that goes towards adoption support services in VAAs.
Well, that was my next question. And you, it's not cheap to, you know, how many social workers does it take for an average VA? If you've got 20 adoptive families, how many adoption social workers do you need post-adoption support?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was a social worker in a voluntary, my manager had a kind of a standard of 15 cases. So I'd have five assessments on the go, five families I was looking and family finding for, and five placements I was supporting, plus then obviously doing all of the extras on duty and stuff
that
like that.
Sounds like a lot. Is that a lot?
It was a lot. But, you know, we worked really hard. And in those days, we were one of the top performing VAAs in the country. Because I remember one year we placed 52 children. We were a tiny team at ChildLink. And it was like the numbers didn't even compare to any other VAA or LA at the time. But we had amazing families because we attracted those families because we marketed ourselves as what we were, which was small, independent. Our ethos was to help and encourage the development of prospective adopters to become parents rather than, you know, we weren't so focused on the process itself. We delivered the process through legal requirements and did it very well. But the ethos was, come to us and we will support you, not just to the point of adoption, but we'll be here forever. That's the challenging bit, isn't it? Can you guarantee forever if you're a voluntary?
Well, I mean, that is a scary question, isn't it? That's the question I asked you off air. Can I ask that question?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's questionable now because, as I said, you know, we are charitable businesses, and if we aren't being supported across the sector to sustain ourselves, then we won't be here. And what I mean by that is, if let's just say we're still placing one in four children, which is what the last round of data showed, no sector of business, and I'll use business in a very loose term when I'm talking about adoption, no sector in business can survive and sustain itself if a quarter of it is at risk. Where does that expertise go? Who's going to deliver these services in these little pockets in the country where, you know, voluntary social workers will spend 2 hours driving back and forth to, but local authorities will not consider, or RAs won't consider adopters in that region because it's just out of their catchment area or it's too far. And
because the question I asked was, what if someone came to you and said, should I go with a VA or should I go with a CVA? It's not a simple question anymore, is it?
It's not a simple question anymore. And I guess the blurry line between RAAs and VAAs has become, you know, much more complex because in essence, a lot of the RAAs, you know, what they've modelled themselves on in terms of their concept is VAAs. So this whole spinning out of adoption services coming together as regions, the modelling that they've done, which is setting up recruitment, preparation, assessment and support teams, is what VAAs have always done. So the label might be different, the funding might be different, but we're all aspiring to do the same thing and we all want to be doing the best for children. And when we're collaborating on things like You Can Adopt, you know, that's a campaign that is cross-sector. So the steering group has people from both parts of the sector and others on. And the message behind that is about giving people choice of where they go. So the agency finder will list all of the agencies in your area, VAAs and RAAs. But there is still, I think, a lack of clarity around, well, what is the difference other than the fact that RAAs directly work with the children and make the decisions around where they go. So if I was a prospective adopter, I might choose an RAA based on that alone. But I think things like adoption support, recommendation from friends and families, you know, the word of mouth and the experience people have had in VAA still stands us in good stead because that's where often a lot of families are coming to us from. And historically, I don't know exactly what the split up now is in terms of ethnicity, but historically, voluntary adoption agencies have attracted much more families from BAME backgrounds and people of colour. Because again, the experiences some of those communities that have had with local authorities and corporate services have not always been positive. So actually going to a local provider or a faith-based organisation or London Black Families, as it was in the early 2000s in London, that organisation was fully staffed by people of colour and attracted huge numbers of black families.
Yeah.
So I think there are still reasons why people would choose a VAA, but if it comes to questions around sustainability, there's no doubt that VAAs are at more risk than RAAs. But the other side of that, of course, is that we could have a new Secretary of State who decides RAAs are no longer the right methodology and they're all disbanded and we start again.
Oh, please don't say that. But talking about You Can Adopt, you mentioned it there, because we're now, I mean, just thinking about voluntary agencies and how they kind of fund themselves and stuff, is there a risk that we've recruited too many adopters now and there's not enough children? And could that be contributing in any way, do you think?
I think it's definitely a risk. I mean, I think voluntaries and RAAs, that whilst there are now more adopters in the system who are approved, certainly what I'm hearing from my peers is that they have had to be much more selective about who they say yes and no to. So we're back to having these sorts of policies in place. And I think RAAs are still, you know, they are still placing children with voluntaries because the numbers demonstrate that. But I think it is that waiting time. If you've got families that you are supporting whilst they wait, it's a really emotional time for prospective adopters.
Yeah.
You know, when they're waiting for a match, and those that get matched very quickly don't experience it. But those who wait around or are being turned down for multiple children, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster. And we've just done some work as part of the National Steering Group for You Can Adopt around the experiences of families waiting. And the messages we're getting from that research very clearly tell us that we're still not, as a sector as a whole, across the board, taking good enough care of those families who are waiting. Because, you know, they find it really emotional. Sometimes they lack support in that waiting period. So we're very focused, of course, on supporting children when they're in their new family, which is absolutely right and proper, but people also need to be supported and handheld whilst they get there. So
yeah, and I think that's interesting because we we got a tweet today actually, and I haven't had a chance to look into it, but we got a tweet today from somebody who's just started going through the process, and their experience so far has been more or less positive, but there was a mention about sexism within some part of the process and some of the paperwork. Now, like I say, we haven't looked too much into it, so we don't know if this is an RA or a VA or whatever, but it could well be that you know, social workers are being given this kind of mandate that, you know, this is a profile of the adopters that we need at this precise moment in time again. I mean, that seems to be going back in time, but
The difficult thing we've got is the data for children is still telling us that, you know, there are close to 3,000 children waiting, and they are in these priority groups that wait the longest. So children from Black minority ethnic backgrounds, children who are older.
Mm.
And well, of course, we talk about older children, we mean sort of 3.5, 4 upwards. We're not talking about teenagers.
No, yeah.
And children with additional needs. Yeah. And so when you've got that still happening, and yet we've got all these adopters who aren't being matched,
yeah,
you know, something isn't working in the system somewhere. And I think that's the responsibility for the voluntaries and the REAs to sort out together. Yeah. And I know that Sarah is looking at how we function around matching, and there's also some research going on the 100 children who've been waiting the longest to find out exactly what's behind the wait.
Mm.
I think these deep dives are giving us some more insight, and then we have to act on it. That's the issue here.
Yeah. If
we collaboratively,
yeah,
that will yield the best results, not only for the children, but also for the voluntaries and the REAs. Because one thing I feel really strongly about, I'm coming up to my 27th anniversary of working in adoption fostering. So I feel like I've kind of seen so many bits of the system from different perspectives. When the REAs were set up, I think that there was a mistake made, because I think REAs are responsible for the children as being part of the legal entity. And what we've set up is a duplication of what already existed. And I think voluntaries should have been tasked with the function of recruiting and preparing and assessing families, and then matching them in regional arrangements with their local REAs, who should have been focused on making sure the children's needs were met. And what by that I mean all of the therapeutic assessments. We're still seeing kids placed and disrupting out of their families because they haven't had proper brother and sister assessments. Mm. You know, their needs haven't been assessed therapeutically, so they're not getting the right support early enough. Mm. And the families can't cope because they weren't prepared for that level of need. Whereas actually, if we split the resource differently and made sure that one side of the system focused on the family and assessment and one side focused on the children's needs and the budget followed, you bring the two halves together and there's some harmony there. Whereas at the moment, you know, with 32 REAs and 30-odd VAAs all trying to recruit families through one campaign, we're all just doing the same thing. To me, it's just a complete nonsense, a waste of resource. So, and the other thing I think that we have to be better at is when children come into care and it looks like they're going to be on an adoption plan, with 60 providers across the country, there's no reason why an early notification can't go out about a specific child or a profile. It doesn't have to be their name and personal details, but just we've got a sibling group of 3 aged 1, 2, and 3. They are Black, Caribbean, Jamaican children. Does anyone have a family who might be a possible match? Because we're not doing that quickly enough. These children wait around 6 months later or a year later, their plans get changed to long-term fostering because the assumption is we can't find a family. And I think, again, we're just failing children. Mm. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether you're an REA or a VAA, if we are failing children in this system with the resources that we have at our disposal, then it's a complete failure on everyone's part.
So I find that very interesting what you've just said there, because in lots of ways the formulation of the RAs was quite innovative in a lot of ways, but actually just didn't go far enough. So the first point. Yeah. And the second point that I wanted to make, having been involved in some of that early days with some of the now RAs, what was very clear back then was that voluntary agencies were seen as supporting this formulation of RAs, but not directly involved. And there was lots of kind of discussions about how they could be involved, because nobody had actually said, this is how we want voluntary agencies to be involved. And then my third point, there might be a fourth, but my third point is this wasn't trialed. You know, regionalization wasn't trialed like the ASF was in 10 different, you know, agencies. It was just a case of this is going to happen, so crack on. Had it been maybe given a couple of years to trial in maybe 5-6 regions, let's say, then maybe this would have been one of the things that had been picked up. Because I think you're right, to have that kind of so many agencies, should we say, I've forgotten my words, which happens that, so sorry about that. To have so many agencies who are trying to do the same thing, and you know, I remember as a prospective adopter not having a clue the difference between a VA and an LA. I wouldn't have known.
I don't think we've really moved on from that.
Yeah.
To be honest.
No.
And how would you know when actually everyone's saying the same thing and doing the same thing? So I think it's I think there's still some element of piloting here. But interestingly, I saw a tweet from the ADCS account today. So there was obviously a conference or a big event going on, and one of the tweets specifically said that one of the assistant directors or directors of children's service at the event was saying very clearly, as far as they were concerned, the RAAs are still a pilot.
Right, okay. That's interesting.
Now, whether that means anything, whether anything is done by that. But I think there's some great work happening. I was in a meeting not that long ago with RAAs, all the heads of RAAs and VAs together. We were in one room. We met at Coram Campus for an away day together. I was involved with Maggie and Sarah in putting some of the day together with other colleagues. And the reality is, you know, we all want the same thing. We all want to do the best for our kids. So it then does come down to, it's the structures around us and the legalities of those structures and funding to a large part that creates barriers. So I think we have to find a different way to do this. But the issue around voluntaries closing, you know, what's going to happen to, we've talked a bit about what's going to happen to the families, Families for Children. What's going to happen to the staff, the teams who've worked there for years and built up this expertise? And one of the reasons adoption services are so expensive to run is that the law demands that we as social workers have a certain level of expertise and experience before we're let loose on adoption work. So inevitably, you've got more senior people with higher, you know, skills and therefore higher remuneration. But if all the voluntaries close and those hundreds and hundreds of years of expertise and experience are lost because people choose to then go and work in their local supermarket rather than find a job in an RAA, which could happen because people are so demoralised when they are at the receiving end of this sort of news. I mean, it's a huge loss of expertise. And again, the ultimate losers in this are the kids that we're trying to help.
Yeah. And having worked for a voluntary agency up until recently, actually, because obviously it was Adoption Plus, not as a social worker, thankfully, because that would be against the law. Each voluntary agency is quite unique in what they offer in terms of the, I guess, aftercare of their families. You know, Adoption Plus really is, it's the only voluntary agency I've worked for, but so unique in terms of their therapeutic interventions. You know, it's lifelong. They have psychologists and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But each VA is quite unique in what they have to offer. So I guess in terms of the loss to, you know, I don't know the agency in question personally, but, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, there will have been something quite unique about them as an agency that, you know, is going to be missed.
The I mean, the team at Families for Children are heavily invested in youth work and adoption support services, placement support services. So again, they roll those out across the region. It's not just their own families they deliver those services to. So there's going to be a loss across the region. These services no longer existing. And they were on the brink of securing a partnership with a fostering organization to develop a combined service. So the fact that, you know, they've run out of time before that could really come to fruition, again, is a huge loss to the sector. And ultimately, as I said, the losers are the kids here because they won't get these amazing services. So
it's, and I think, it's interesting because I, going back a few years, I had a friend who was kind of quite close to an entrepreneur, like a gazillionaire, who was sort of involved in sort of altruistic things. Didn't know that, did you, Scott? Anyway, he doesn't care less.
I don't care, unless he's giving me money. I don't really give a toss.
No, that's true. And he said, his comment on the whole RAA sort of experiment was that it looked to him that it was making it ripe for privatization, that you were kind of paring it down. And I look at that now and I go, well, maybe that was the plan, but looking at it now, who would put money into this system now?
Exactly. I mean, adoption, as I think we've talked about before, is in a state of flux. And we want adoption to modernize. We want it to change. We want it to be revolutionized in so many different ways. And I'm absolutely committed to, you know, the epicenter of that change. It has to be the needs of the children who grow up to be adopted adults. And if we don't listen to what we're being told repeatedly and get it right, then we're accountable then, because actually if we're not listening, we talk about lived experience and co-production, you know, let's put it to good use. And so I think there's lots still that the voluntary sector can be involved in terms of leading that, because again, historically, the feedback from adopted adults and youth groups has come from the voluntary sector, because we've been doing this in some cases, you know, for 30, 40 years already. It's not new. And even at IAC, we've just turned 25, but, you know, we've had a group of adopted people meeting regularly for the best part of 20 years. And that group has evolved and changed, and it inevitably feeds into our service development. And when we met together recently for the away day I was just talking about as a combined sector, our first speakers were from Scottish Adoption, and they were young people who've done an amazing project.
We know them, don't worry.
Oh, they're a cracking bunch of kids, them, bless their hearts. Young people, kids.
There is great stuff happening. Yes, you know, one of my kind of objectives as being a board member and the vice chair of CVA is to kind of help people think about, well, how do they evolve? Because actually, if the numbers of children are dwindling, and if local authorities and RAAs want to be more sustainable in terms of those children being placed with their own families, because they want them to be placed locally or because it's easier for them to support them, then we have to respond to that as a sector. We can't stick our head in the sand and pretend it's not happening. And that's where the skill set loss becomes then a huge drain, because actually we can put those skills to great use elsewhere, whether it is in permanence work, with kinship families, with foster carers, thinking about exactly what we were just talking about, you know, specialist services for children and young people or adopters, or even back to this very, very specialist recruitment for children who are in those really difficult and hard to place categories. So, I think there's still a long road ahead of us in terms of being around and being able to deliver, but we have to also do that with one foot firmly grounded in reality. And we're not going to get back to the heydays of adoption, because nobody wants that, because we were placing children left, right, and centre without much thought and not always for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Even if it was all being done, you know, fabulously and legally with lots of support in place. But if adoption is changing, then we have to also be part of that change.
So just before we kind of start to round up, what about, because obviously you are the CEO of a voluntary agency yourself. You're not just vice chair at CVA. I mean, COVID, you're international. You don't just, you know, you're not just in the UK. You actually, how has COVID affected what you do? And
I mean, let's start with the positives. It's allowed us to kind of step back just a bit and think about what is the best way to deliver our services and to get the best impact. And we now know, and we knew very early on in the pandemic across the country in lots of different ways, that actually virtual delivery of some services is okay. Mm. It's not the same, might not always be as impactful and as good, but actually, if you're still aiming for that A-grade figure, which ranges from 70% to 100%, if you're in that ballpark, that's good enough as far as I'm concerned, because actually you're still having great impact. So rather than this rush to get back to do everything in person, let's think about what services need to be in person.
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on those. And so internationally, I think that what we saw was, of course, when there was travel restrictions in place, people couldn't travel overseas to meet their children. So we did have some cases where people had been matched with a child and then couldn't travel to see them for 6, 9, 12 months. And of course, every day in a child's life, whether they're in foster care or in a children's home, is huge. So, and we had one family who'd waited almost 12 months since being matched with their child in Thailand. And they, on the last flight out of England to Thailand before the next lot of restrictions and lockdown hit. So for people, it was real. We had one adopter who was a kinship adopter who sadly died before his child could come and join them in England. Thankfully, that was an isolated case, but I mean, everything they went through to get to that point and then for that to happen was awful and really sad. But we're now back to this issue. It's linked to COVID, but not directly, but it's linked to everything we've talked about today, is if people are approaching their REAs or VAAs and being turned away because there isn't capacity to take on more adopters or they're perceived to not be offering something that we really need, then they are coming to us and they are inquiring about adopting from overseas. And as we've talked about on the podcast before, you know, that isn't an option for everyone because it costs people the best part of £30,000 because there is really no funding in international adoption from central government. So the equivalent of the interagency fee is self-funded, basically. So people are paying that money to be able to be given the service from IAC to that deems whether they're suitable or not. So there's, again, there's no guarantees that your money's going to buy you an approval. It's a access to the system to determine whether you're suitable. So those families, you know, that are coming to us because there isn't an option for them in the UK, potentially, they, once they know that there's no option internationally because of the funding issue, we're, again, we're just losing families who are well motivated. And I know this Children's Care Review was talking about mobilizing the people who'd come forward to care for Ukrainian families. And but it's not as simple as that because there are so many restrictions that are still in place. I know the system is more open and we want to be encouraging and inclusive, but if you don't have the physical space for a child, you know, then fostering is not an option for you. And sometimes adoption isn't. If you can't afford to do it internationally, then it's a non-starter. You're kind of barred from entry. But these are people who are well-motivated and well-intentioned. And not that that's a prerequisite for them being able to adopt, but if they can offer a child who is genuinely in need of adoption something, then, you know, my job as a CEO is to make that work and to support them and develop them to get to the point of what we as a sector consider someone suitable to adopt.
I think that's one of the benefits of, that would be one of the key benefits, is that the flexibility and kind of a bit of creative thinking that you get from VAs. I mean, I would probably still go with it. If I was back now, I would go with a VA. I think that's what I would see. But I would go, I would go in knowing that I'm probably going to wait a bit longer.
Yeah, but, and I think people are still doing that, Al, because but we don't have the children directly and therefore people are waiting. They have talked to other adopters, of course, who said, well, we waited a year. And if people are okay and able to do that because they feel it's a better fit for them, then of course we still want to work with them. But it is this issue of what's happening nationally, really, and where are the children? Why aren't the numbers even stable at the moment? They're kind of nosediving. Yet the numbers of children waiting the longest are growing. So,
And that then asks the question about who you're recruiting, doesn't it? It's sort of like this. So you're taking the people who you think are going to take. Yeah. You know, I always wonder whether there's an element of people sort of that disguise compliance. Yes, I'll take this. And then getting through getting through the through to approved, you know, to the hallowed land, and then saying, maybe not.
Interestingly, on an international level, when we have our prospective doctors come to us, their point of entry on that scale of uncertainty in children's development is usually higher, because it's a perceived notion that actually when you're abroad, you're going to have very limited information about a child's background and health, because most of the children who are in orphanages and truly needing adoption have been abandoned. And there is no information about them or their birth history. And so actually our adopters are already prepared to be taking a much more informed risk at the point of matching.
Yeah.
And we've seen that replicated when they changed to domestic adoption and a match with a child in this country, that their ability to manage uncertainty is usually high. Not always, of course. But I think that for me, I'll say this really quickly because I know we're running out of time, but we're expecting an awful lot, you know, from people. And the average person who's going to respond to an adoption recruitment campaign, whatever the message is, isn't in it at that point to be a therapeutic parent. That doesn't even factor in their head.
Yes.
So this journey we need to, and we know we need to take them on this journey because the kids' needs demand it. But so I'd be more comfortable with the sector shrinking and still having voluntary and regional arrangements, but actually fewer adopters being coming through the system, but the right people who we feel we can take on this journey. And, you know, and I've worked with those families over many years in different capacities in my own career. So there are amazing people out there. You're both adoptive parents, and I know you've had, you know, good days and bad days as parents. So people can do amazing things. And it's our job as the sector combined, voluntary and regional, to deliver the best for you and your children, and ensure that it's lifelong. So I think there's still space for collaboration and innovation and joint working. There's certainly the right people around the table to make it happen. But resources have to back it up, as always. So if we're to Will Quince being our minister, then one of the messages I know he's already heard but has to hear repeatedly is, this can't be done in half measures. If the funding and the infrastructure isn't there in the redesign of the care system, then it will still fail to deliver true care.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot to think about there, Sat.
A lot. Hell of a lot.
This is intriguing because I think that so often I don't know about you, Scott, but I looked at people coming to adoption and sort of there's this whole world going on behind this system, isn't there, that hugely impacts on their lives, and they don't realize they're stepping into this really complex environment.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything, isn't it? Unless you know the nuts and bolts behind everything that's going on, which, to be fair, you know, 17 years ago or however long it is, I wouldn't have had a clue. I just thought that you went through this front door and then it all kind of happened. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to downplay the realities of it, because it's, you know, it's hard. And, you know, I read so much criticism, as I'm sure you both do as well, online about, you know, the fee for adoption and how that's selling children and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But if you know the mechanics behind it, you can, you know, whether you're whatever aspect you come from, if you can understand the mechanics and you understand why these things work the way they do. You know, it's not just a case, nobody's selling a child, you know. And I'm sure that there have been occasions, and we know there have been occasions where, you know, children potentially shouldn't have been adopted, but, you know, that's rare, it's few and far between, etc. So,
you are. I mean, right. The children we're working with have been through a complex legal system to get to the point. And that's why it's so sad that there are children on placement orders who we can't find families for. Because these are children who, at that point in their life, have been deemed to be in true need of adoption. And it's the same internationally. You know, the children are coming through quite complex care systems. Mm-hmm. And again, the profile of children we're placing internationally now isn't that dissimilar to the children being placed in this country. So for the same reasons, because those countries are also trying to develop their care systems and place children locally where they can also and get them into kinship arrangements. So I do think we are moving closer to adoption being for the children who genuinely need it. And if we can continue to evolve the conversation around what does that then look like legally and in a family context, then I think there's huge potential there. And actually that then for me as a leader in the sector makes me feel much more optimistic. Whatever the state of the sector is right now. And I think we are in a bit of a state, but I hope that we can kind of sort that and rebalance and move forward together.
Yeah, I mean, it's still early days, isn't it? Sat, thank you so much for coming on at such short notice. I know you've had a mad busy week and we've all had an emotional week.
I thought we were going to go on for hours talking about this week. So
yeah, well, it's always good to think about these issues with you guys because you do ask very probing questions that, you know, challenge the mind.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, I'm sure Al does. I just state stupid facts, I think, for the most part.
It's always a pleasure. Adoption. Always a pleasure, never a chore. Well, thank you so much, Satwinder. Are you going to the Adoption Special Guardian Leadership Board national whirly gig?
Yeah.
Okay. We should have asked him about that.
Let's not. Do you know what? I've got a ticket. I'm going as well.
Fabulous. I shall see you there.
Yeah, I don't know why I've got a ticket, but I got asked to go, so I'm going to go. So maybe I'll chat to you and we can talk about...
So when you say ticket, can we just clear this up? Because there's a lot of people who get very confused by some things you come out with. This isn't a concert you're going to have. So explain the word ticket.
All right. Well,
Do you mean you've been asked to represent the adopters reference group?
Kind of, yeah.
Right, so don't say ticket because you know we'll get trolled to hell for saying ticket. Oh, look, he's asking again.
Go on to Eventbrite and...
It's fun.
Anywho, it's late in the night. We've all had an exhausting political week. So thank you, Satwinder. As always, Scott, the pleasure was all yours. Bon Jovi.
Goodbye.
Actually, before we go, say, and good night. Go on, Salwinder.
And good night.
Well, that was a good ending, wasn't it? 100% what's going on, Scott.
I know. Sorry, it's been one of those weeks for me.
Oh, what? You've had to get...
I'm still recovering, thank you.
Oh, Moody. I was going to tell you something nice that someone had said about you now, but I'm not... That's it.
Don't be so cruel. I need to hear good things. I genuinely do.
No, I was talking to some of your fellow Scots and about some work for us. Rustling up some work.
Scots.
And then we're going, Scots. Orc, I hope a Scots are fine. We were really worried. Because they were ladies.
Oh, God, that could be anybody then.
I'm not going to tell anymore, but they were genuinely bothered about you.
Oh, well, at least somebody is, I suppose.
You know, of course, I dissuaded them from any sort of nonsense.
Of course you did.
I told them the wicked truth and showed them the photographs. So.
Have you been pulling my kilt photographs out again? Thanks for that.
Oh, please don't.
Anyway.
Things you can never unsee.
Are we 140? Shall I? Because you did it last time, I think.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, cool.